You are listening to Investing Matters, brought to you in association with London South East. This is the show that provides informative, educational, and entertaining content from the world of investing. We do not give advice, so please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Investing Matters podcast. My name is Peter Higgins, and you can find me at Conkers3 on Twitter, X. Today, I have the huge privilege of speaking to Jamie Catherwood, a vice president at O'Shaughnessy Asset Management, a quantitative long-only equity firm and leading custom indexing provider. He is also the founder of Investor Amnesia, a company dedicated to financial history content with over six figures in revenue since its launch in 2020. Investor Amnesia has a weekly newsletter with over 15,000 subscribers, thousands of web visitors, and two online history courses featuring lectures from Mark Andreessen, Jim Chanos, Neil Ferguson, and many more. This has led to multiple appearances on Bloomberg TV, Bloomberg Odlots podcast, annual guest lectures at Yale University School of Management, and keynote presentations at finance conferences across America. Jamie, welcome to this Investing Matters podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege to be here.
Thank you very much, Jamie. Jamie, I want to start because one of the things that we, when we first started speaking, you made it clear to me that you're half Brit, half American, brought and raised up in the United States. I want to start really going back and do a little bit of history myself here, laying the foundations by asking you a little bit about your fantastic family lineage regarding the Sir Frederick Catherwood, Vice President of the European Parliament, and your writer, father, Christian Catherwood, is that correct?
Yeah, that's my uncle, Christian.
Uncle, sorry. Yeah,
Christopher okay. Catherwood.
Can you share a bit of that history with us as well, please? Obviously, they were quite important to you growing up.
Yeah, there's a couple interesting Frederick Catherwoods actually in our history. Even going back a little further in the 1800s, there was a Frederick Catherwood, grew up in the UK, and he met with an American explorer and diplomat named John Lloyd Stephens. And the two of them actually traveled through Central America and are credited with the rediscovery of the ancient Maya civilization. So if anyone's seen The Lost City of Zed, then it's essentially that same story, except I think that was for the Aztecs maybe, or the Incas, and Frederick Catherwood's work was in the ancient Maya. But yeah, he went around Central America for 3 years and they uncovered like 41 ancient Mayan ruin sites, which I had the privilege actually of visiting one of them last year in Tulum in Mexico, which was fascinating. But all that to say that there's definitely a long line of Catherwoods and historical interest. And so it's something that basically that whole side of the family, we've always had a real passion for history. And going to my grandfather, Sir Frederick Catherwood, he, like you mentioned, was in European Parliament for three decades, perhaps, and kind of helped spearhead getting Britain to join the EU. And he passed away before Brexit. That was kind of the one positive, that he wasn't around to see his life's work undone. But he had a deep passion for history, especially family history. He started writing something called Catherwood Chronicles, which one day I hope to finish, where he kind of traced back our lineage and detail the kind of story of the Catherwood family. And then, as you said, my uncle, Christopher Catherwood, has written untold amounts of books on Winston Churchill and World War II and other periods of World War II history. And so, again, history definitely runs in the family and has been a big influence. My dad, as well, is a big historian and passionate about learning from the past. So it's kind of inevitable that I would end up doing something like Investor Amnesia.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for that. Now, please, can you share with us your academic background, what you studied and where, please, Jamie?
Yeah, so in that vein, I grew up, and I think when I was like 8 or 9, I decided that I was going to go to school in the UK, specifically London. My dad was born and raised in London, in Ealing, and he came over in the 80s to go to Columbia to get his degree, and then met my mom and stayed in the United States. But When I was young, I grew up going over to London to visit family, and it was just always my favorite city in the world. And I decided I'm going to go to school there. And so when it came time to apply to universities in high school, I only applied to British universities. I think three of the five were based in London. And my dad's philosophy was always, if you think that you're going to go into business, then you will probably get an MBA, probably more his generation thinking. But if that's the case, then what's the use in studying business undergrad? Because then you'll just end up studying business undergrad and postgrad. And so do something that you're passionate about in undergrad and will kind of round you out as a person. And so for me, the obvious choice was history. And so I got into King's College London, thankfully. Could not have been more central than that. And so it definitely fulfilled the lifelong dream. And it was a great time. I spent 3 years just reading and writing about history. Absolutely loved it. And it was a useful kind of first glimpse into the world of financial and economic history, because I took some interesting courses on like the Weimar hyperinflation and British economic history as well. And so it definitely set me up to continue that interest in research post-college once I kind of got into the working world.
And what did you do after college? Where did you go after that to study?
So after college, So during my time at King's, I became interested in investing, and I, of course, was not taking any finance or economics classes, just history. And so any kind of research or education that I did was on my own. And I had two friends suggest that I listen to the Invest Like the Best podcast, hosted by Patrick O'Shaughnessy, and Masters in Business by Barry Ritholtz. And so I really just started listening to those podcasts as soon as the new episode dropped, went through the whole backlog and just wrote down every term I didn't know, et cetera, and slowly learned enough to be able to kind of fake my way through a job interview and get a job in Washington, D.C. at a company called Arthur J. Gallagher in their institutional investment consulting division. And so for a history major that I just recently graduated, it was probably the best kind of way to immerse myself in the investment industry, because all day, every day, all we were doing was meeting with different investment managers across different asset classes and styles and geographies, and just hearing from the portfolio managers and analysts, you know, how they went about constructing their portfolios, finding names to invest in, et cetera, and just hearing their kind of views on the markets and economy. It's just a really interesting way to kind of take in a lot of information and learn the whole spectrum, basically, of, you know, types of investment managers and approaches to investing. And so I did that for close to 2 years. And then in that span of time, I had cold emailed Patrick O'Shaughnessy, who again had been the host of Invest Like the Best, and said to him, you know, you were a philosophy undergrad major and I was a history major, and your podcast helped me learn enough to kind of get this first job. And so I'd love to take you to lunch or get you a drink just to kind of say thank you for what you unknowingly helped me do. And to my surprise, he responded pretty quickly and said that he would be more than happy to get lunch and appreciated the email. And so one day in the summer of 2018, I got up at like 4 a.m. in DC and drove to Connecticut and met with Patrick for lunch. And then I actually, once I decided that I was going for lunch, I also figured, you know, hey, I got one of the podcast hosts I listened to agree to meet. And so I then cold messaged Barry Ritholtz on Twitter and said, hey, I'm coming up anyway. And I used the fact that I was getting lunch with Patrick as a way to kind of establish credibility with Barry and said, do you want to get breakfast? Because I figured if he thought Patrick was willing to meet with me, then I can't be, you know, too crazy a guy from the internet. And so I ended up getting breakfast and lunch with Patrick and Barry in the same day, stayed in touch with Patrick, then met Jim, his dad, O'Shaughnessy. And yeah, I think a year later, Jim O'Shaughnessy called me and said, you know, Patrick and I want you to come work at O'Shaughnessy Asset Management. And I put in my 2 weeks the next day. So it was quite a ride. And 5 years later,
what amazes me is that, you know, you have the conversation with Patrick, and then you obviously being watched in the sense of how you're going and conducting yourself and how you're establishing yourself across, you know, people are watching without you even knowing. And then Patrick and Jim approach you and say, you know what, you need to come and work with us. That's absolutely amazing, Jamie.
Thank you. Yeah, it was, thinking back, I was such a scrub. I think I showed up in a suit to lunch with Patrick at this just like average Thai place. I was definitely young and wide-eyed, but it was a great experience. And yeah, I feel very fortunate to have then landed a job at O'Shaughnessy, and it's been a great ride. But yeah, power of the cold email. You never know what it can lead to. My philosophy has always been the worst thing that happens is someone says no or doesn't respond, which doesn't really have any material impact on your life.
Brilliant. Love that philosophy. Now, we're going to briefly talk about O'Shaughnessy Asset Management, if we may, just to get a bit of an overview of the sheer scale and size of the company and types of clients that you facilitate.
Yeah, so we are a quantitative equity manager. So we've been managing money since the 90s. O'Shaughnessy Asset Management as a firm has been in operation since 2007, but a lot of the team that is still around today, that core unit, some of the people go back to the 90s with Jim O'Shaughnessy, who wrote the book, What Works on Wall Street, which your listeners may be familiar with. And he was kind of one of the early pioneers in factor investing. And so he published What Works on Wall Street, then set up O'Shaughnessy Capital Management. And then that went under Bear Stearns. They luckily spun out of Bear Stearns before everything went south. And then when they spun out, they formed O'Shaughnessy Asset Management. But so for almost two decades, the firm has been managing money through SMA accounts. So that's what kind of makes our firm a bit unique, is that instead of offering our strategies through a mutual fund or ETF, we have historically handled accounts in a separately managed account vehicle. And so that's important because in 2019, we essentially, like Amazon Web Services, was really just Amazon offering externally all the tools that the company was already using internally to manage the business. We took all the tools that we had built over two decades, the technology and kind of infrastructure for handling all these separately managed accounts, and put it into a platform that we call Canvas, and then essentially turned the keys over to advisors and provided them with a investment platform that they can build models, manage accounts, rebalance, everything they would want to do all in one web-based platform. And this has coincided with the rise of custom indexing, which we pioneered that term. And what that means is that direct indexing, the predecessor, you know, is a strategy where you're simply replicating an index, but instead of owning, you know, say the S&P 500 and ETF in a direct index, you're owning the S&P 500, but with the individual shares. And so you actually own the individual stocks, which means that you can do some really cool customizations, tax management, and other capabilities that you're just not able to do in an ETF because you're just pooled in with thousands of other investors. And so Canvas launched in September 2019, and we're approaching $5 billion in assets on the platform. So it's been quite a growth story. It's been interesting to be a part of because when I joined the firm, I think it was 6 months before we went public with it. So I have kind of been along for the ride since day one, and it's been really a great experience to be a part of that journey.
Sounds phenomenal. Thank you for sharing that, especially the bit about Canvas and the technology that they've utilized. Can you tell us a little bit about your specific role as Vice President Client Portfolio Specialist at OSAM, please, Jamie?
Yeah, so I've had a few kind of different roles within the firm. As you can imagine, when you're kind of pioneering a new type of category and investment platform, a lot of people do a lot of different things, wear a lot of hats. And so I would boil down kind of everything, though, that I've done at OSAM into a kind of, I view myself as the bridge, kind of a normal client portfolio manager role between the research team and the advisor relationships team. Because with Canvas, we're not offering it to retail. We are partnering with advisor firms, and then they use the platform with their clients. And so being a quant firm and with custom indexing, having so much tax implications and tax management capabilities, there's a lot of kind of wonky concepts to explain. And so my role is kind of translating the intricacies of, you know, our portfolio management strategies and the capabilities on the platform into something digestible that, you know, our sales team can use. And that's helpful for advisors to use with their clients when they're trying to explain the benefits of custom indexing over ETFs, et cetera. And so to me, it's just basically doing exactly what I did as a history major, just changing the inputs. It's just, you know, taking information, data, et cetera, and then compiling it, pulling out what's important, and then putting it into a new piece of content.
Thank you for that, Jamie. Now, for those that don't understand or have not met this terminology before, please could you just share with our global audience, Jamie, what quant investing is and essentially how it can reduce human bias and emotions as well, please?
Yeah, so quantitative investing, you are essentially trying to identify the characteristics of stocks that for decades, you know, so our data goes back to 1963. And essentially what quantitative investing is looking at from 1963 to the present day, what are the characteristics of stocks that have outperformed over time? And what are the characteristics and traits of stocks that have underperformed over time? And then how persistent are those characteristics? And characteristics, you can just swap with the word factors. That's just kind of more quanti term. So that you can look for stocks that share those same characteristics today. And so it's kind of like Moneyball for stocks. For anyone that's seen Moneyball, the kind of, you know, light bulb moment for them was all that matters is getting on base. And to get on, you can only score runs by getting on base. So what should you look for is players that you can get on the cheap that get on base consistently. And so those are the, they then looked for traits, and that trait being, does he get on base? And then they try and find undervalued players. With quantitative investors, you're basically doing the same thing. You're trying to find stocks that outperform the market and look for the kind of precursors to that. So is a company, you know, strong earnings growth, you know, strong momentum? Are they priced cheaply? Can you get them at a discounted valuation? And then once you identify those characteristics and factors that you want to look for in companies, then you can set up a systematic trading approach that just looks for these companies and then rebalances the portfolio accordingly. And you can set it up to kind of automate it. And that's important because, you know, as a market historian, one of the most, one of the largest, the main lessons of history is that humans don't change. Jim O'Shaughnessy always liked to say that human nature is the last sustainable source of arbitrage, because while the technology that investors use to trade on the market has changed dramatically since the first shares were traded in Amsterdam in 1602, the actual human behavior of investors making those trades has not changed one iota. It's exactly the same, which is pretty remarkable. And so taking the human element out of the equation and not allowing yourself to make those mistakes by overtrading and making an emotional decision. If you just set up your portfolio to be systematic and quantitative, you are really kind of taking out the biggest risk to your portfolio, and that's you as a human. And so if you just automate it, just like passive investing, you can kind of eliminate a lot of the problems that plague investors.
Thank you for that full response, Jamie. Appreciate that. Now Jamie, you talked about the performance and finding the best value and being very, very analytical regarding quantitative investing. We've got a situation at the moment where the S&P 500 is up 17% year to date. Meanwhile, if we exclude the Magnificent Seven, which is Google, Amazon, Apple, Meta, Microsoft, Nvidia, and Tesla, the S&P 493 would be up 0.38%. Meanwhile, the Magnificent Seven is up 65%. It would appear to me that history is telling us that growth stocks will continue to prevail over value investing for a little while longer, at least. What are your thoughts?
Forecasting is a dangerous game, but there's a couple things in there. So the first, I would just say, I think that's a really great way to set up one of the benefits of custom indexing in Canvas. And so going back to earlier time with the S&P 500, owning it in an ETF, or you're just owning the share of an ETF like SPY, or you're owning the 500 securities in an account replicating the S&P 500. If you own the ETF and the index is up 17% for the year, it doesn't matter that 493 of those companies are only up, you know, whatever you said, 0.8% or something for the year. Because if you sell that one share of the S&P 500 ETF, you will have to pay taxes because you'll have a capital gain. But in a custom index, because you own those individual securities, that means that when the seven Magnificent Seven stocks are up 65%, you can offset the gains on those 60 on those seven names by harvesting losses and selling the stocks in the remaining 493 basket at a loss. And so throughout the year, in a given calendar year, 36% of stocks in the index will be down. And so if you own an ETF, you can't do anything with that. But if you own these same stocks in a custom index, you can just repeatedly harvest those losses and make sure that you are not having to pay as much taxes on your winners, but also just use that as a tax asset that you can offset somewhere else. So we'll have situations where an advisor's client like knows they're going to sell their business in a year or two. And so they want to aggressively build up a tax asset and harvest losses so that when they sell their business, they can basically offset the tax cost of doing that. And so I think over time, as technology continues to improve and costs fall, I think you'll just see an even bigger wave of custom indexing accounts open, because it's really just a no-brainer. You can own the same exposure, but also get all the tax benefits in addition to any other customizations like ESG, SRI, you name it. And so that is kind of the more interesting, I think, element of that scenario, with the massive outperformance of just a few names, is the opportunities that that provides for custom indexing and tax management.
Brilliant. I love that response, Jamie. Thank you. Now, I want to talk very briefly now about your personal investing strategy before we get to talk about investor amnesia. You've just shared with me, Jamie, your investing style. I know you've got some restrictions on what you can and can't do as well.
Yeah. So at OSAM, we can't trade individual stocks. And so my investing strategy is pretty boring. It's just, you know, in our 401k and a few passive funds in IRA. And so to me, it's keeping things simple, partly because I have to keep things simple for compliance reasons. So nothing too interesting there. Just to me at this age, it's important to just keep contributing, you know, keep putting money away, because compounding is the biggest benefit that you can kind of unlock at a younger age. And so nothing too crazy from a personal investing standpoint, but just trying to stay the course and continue contributing to the portfolio.
Thank you. So thus far, you see, you've been investing for a little while now. What's been your greatest lessons of just applying and compounding your money into the markets? Because I'm taking it from that, even before you went to O'Shaughnessy, you weren't interested in the crypto wave that was hitting everybody else that were in their early 20s.
Yeah, I wasn't too interested in that, but I definitely did make some stupid mistakes. One of the first stocks that I bought when I was at Gallagher, fresh out of college, was, you probably don't know this one, but MoviePass. It was big in the US for a little while. It was a company, but the idea was that you would be able to pay for subscription. I think they started at like $10 a month, which is just insane to think about in hindsight. But for $10 a month, you could go to a movie theater and see unlimited movies per month at the MoviePass, like theaters in their kind of orbit. And so they sent you a debit card and you paid 10 bucks a month. But when you went to a movie theater, you would use this debit card, and then MoviePass would pay the movie theater the full price for the ticket. And so just already didn't make sense economically. But they had this whole argument of, you know, well, they'd partner with the movie chains and they would make up for money in concessions. And so somehow they'd all figure it out and they'd be profitable. It was started by one of the guys that was at the start at Netflix. And then he was the president of Redbox, which in the US is like those kiosks you see at grocery stores where you can rent DVDs. And so in my mind, I thought, you know, this guy knows the movie business. He knows the movie industry. And as a consumer, I mean, it was great. I love going to the movies. And so I used the pass. And so I bought the stock, nothing crazy. It was fresh out of college. So I think I owned like, you know, 8 shares at $13 or something. But for, I think like a week or two, I bought shares, I think at $8. And there was a 2 week period where every day I logged in and it was like, your shares are up 20%. And I just thought, wow, this is like meme stocks before meme stocks were a thing. But there was all over Reddit people talking about MoviePass, et cetera. And then all the smart people on Twitter were saying, you know, this makes no sense. How can you pay $10 a month, see unlimited movies, and the company pays full price for each ticket? That doesn't make any sense. But every day you logged into, you know, E-Trade and saw it up 20% again. And so it's just that feedback loop of people saying you're wrong, but you look at your portfolio and you keep making money. And so you just become blindsided to any kind of criticism, because the only thing that matters in investing, you know, is making money. And if you're doing that, then it just seems like everyone else is, you know, being a hater. And so eventually then the stock started falling 20% every day. Luckily, I still got it out at a profit, but it was definitely a lesson of, you know, a clear example of how a lot of these manias and stuff throughout history start, because I would consider myself a pretty rational person, but still, when, you know, you check your account and you just are printing money every day for like a 2 week period, it's easy to start thinking, I've solved investing, you know, like I must be really good at this. And so that was an interesting early lesson for me. And so whenever I talk about these kind of historical bubbles and manias and talk about the, you know, stupid decisions that investors made at that time, I always point out the fact that I am not immune, nor is anyone, from these types of behavioral errors, because I certainly made one myself.
And we all do, Jamie. I want to move now, please, and talk to you about investor amnesia, how it started, the rapid growth of it, and how it just took off. Because, you know, you obviously working at the time as well at O'Shaughnessy, I think, at the time, and you launched it, and it just went absolutely almost parabolic. It became a mania itself, didn't it? If we can use that term.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully one that doesn't pop.
No, it won't, trust me.
Yeah, so after I graduated college and was in my first job at Gallagher, I was a couple months in, and I've always been someone that really likes the kind of, I really love writing. I think that's my strongest skill. And I missed that kind of deep research and then writing process that I'd been doing for 3 years at King's as a history student. And so when I was at Gallagher, I had the same friend who recommended I listen to those podcasts also recommend to me that I get on Twitter to network. So I've always been someone that really enjoys networking and kind of just meeting new people and growing a personal network. And I was trying to do that on LinkedIn, reaching out to people in DC area, seeing if they would get lunch or a drink. And then my friend Connor said, you know, you should use Twitter. And I obviously didn't believe him, because how would Twitter be useful for networking? But turns out it was probably the best advice I'd ever received. And so he was very plugged into finance Twitter. And so I just went on and followed everybody that he followed, and kind of quickly picked up on the fact that there were a lot of people sharing really interesting content, in the form of blogs, podcasts, et cetera. And I thought, I'm not going to teach people, you know, I'm a year into my first job in the investing industry and I'm a history major. I'm probably not going to have too many novel insights on, you know, how Fed decisions are going to impact the market. I have zero experience and probably a tenth of the knowledge as these people putting out content on Twitter. But the one area that I do have a kind of knowledge advantage in is history. And I missed writing history articles. And so I just kind of figured maybe I'll do a short series, like 3 or 5 posts on interesting people or moments from financial history. And so I got an account on Medium and started thinking of what I could, you know, write an article on. And I published my first one about crypto, actually, ironically, because I really am not that interested in crypto. But it was about Bitcoin and these massive stones in a Pacific island called Yap, where they would, these islanders on the island of Yap would take a canoe to this other island that had a lot of limestone, and they would basically carve out these huge, like 800 pound limestone discs, and then transport them back to Yap Island. And that was their currency. And when they get back, the chief would come out and basically assign a value to all these massive rocks. And what was interesting is that just him assigning a value to it and people on this island believing that these stones had value was enough for it to be a viable currency. And there were interesting scenarios where, you know, on one of these journeys back from the island of limestone to Yap, the heavy rock actually sunk through the base of the canoe and went to the ocean floor. But then when they got back to Yap and they were doing the kind of valuation process with the chief, they communicated that this stone had fallen to the bottom of the floor and described, you know, its size and kind of weight. And someone still, you know, purchased and owned that rock, even though they were never going to see it. And it just kind of exemplified the power of just like the belief in a store of value. And it was just an interesting comparison for, you know, if people think Bitcoin is not viable just because it's like stupid internet money. All that really matters is if people believe it has value and is a store of value. And so that was my first post. And then from there, to my surprise, people were very interested in this kind of content. And I think the advantage that I had was that there was nobody, at least in the finance Twitter sphere, doing purely financial history content. There are a lot of great writers like Morgan Housel frequently writes about history, but that was not always his, you know, main topic. And so I think most people are lovers of history. It's just whether they are presented history in the right way. I always think that people who love history and people who think history is just names and dates, the kind of inflection point for which way people end up going is whether they had a good history teacher in high school, or I guess GCSEs, and whether they kind of brought those stories to life or just made history about names and dates. And so people responded well to these financial history articles. And so I just kept writing them more every week. And then eventually I had a lot of people telling me I needed to launch my own website. And I said, I agree, but I have no idea how to make a website. And then that was when a guy named Adam Collins reached out, never spoken to him before, and said, you know, I'll build your website for free. And so I said, deal. And I spent untold hours with Adam building the Investor Amnesia website, and then launched in 2019. And at that point, I also started the weekly Sunday Reads newsletter, which tried to put kind of major events of each week into historical perspective. And it was then really during COVID that things really went kind of hockey stick. That was a very interesting period to live through, obviously for everybody. But also as a history nerd, it was really interesting to see kind of everybody in society start looking back to history, because this was something that nobody had ever experienced before. And so the amount of interest, especially from an investment perspective, people were just looking for any sort of, you know, guidepost for what the future might look like. And so, you know, everyone started going back to the Spanish influenza. And being a real history nerd, I went back even farther to see how, like, you know, cholera outbreaks in 17th century Amsterdam affected rent and housing prices. And so things really took off during COVID. And then during that, I kind of thought, what's the next step we can take Investor Amnesia content to? And that was doing an online course where I tried to use the network of interesting people, mix of academia and actual investment professionals with the passion for history, and try and put together a course where I could pull some of the people from that network I've created and have them give an hour-long lecture on something related to financial history. The first course was on bubbles, manias, and frauds. And so had some great speakers. Legendary Jim Chanos, he did a lecture on his kind of all his shorts since starting his career in the 80s, which was really interesting, kind of went through all the case studies. And then we had Will Getzman from Yale talk about the South Sea bubble, and we had people talk about the railway mania. And that did well. And so then I did another course on the financial history of empires, which had Niall Ferguson talking about the kind of rise and fall of empires, and Mark Andreessen talking about the golden age of piracy and the similarities between pirate economics and startup economics, which was really interesting. And so, yeah, the growth of investor amnesia certainly took me by surprise. If you had told me in college that after college I would be doing financial history in the investment industry, and it would be a profitable side business, I definitely would not have believed you. But it's been a great ride, and I just am very fortunate to have a kind of passion that has been able to get translated into a kind of actual business and website. And so it's been, yeah, it's been a fun ride.
It's been phenomenal, and it's obviously led to you being on major news channels, including Bloomberg as well, Jamie. So huge congratulations with that. I want to touch, if I may, with going back into the history, and you touched on it a bit earlier. It looks like we owe a lot to the Dutch entrepreneurs and the investors regarding giving us the first IPO, the first dividends, the first stock exchange. Could you just share with our listeners the importance of what they achieved and how it relates to what we're doing now?
Yeah, so as you pointed out, the Dutch were very innovative, and they were basically everything related to markets and investing, every kind of first, as you said, all goes back to Amsterdam and Holland. And even more specifically, the Dutch East India Company, which formed in, I always switch it up, 1602, I think, was when the shares first started trading kind of off the exchange. Well, at that point, there wasn't even an exchange. And then in 1609, I believe the Amsterdam Stock Exchange formally opened and trading began. But yeah, it was this Dutch East India Company that kind of ignited the stock market revolution that has now gone on for centuries. And there were so many interesting stories at the start there, because, you know, they just, like everyone, was trying to figure out how all this was going to work. There was no real kind of template to follow. And so you had interesting things like in 1609, also there was the first bear raid and kind of short selling activist campaign by a guy named Isaac Le Maire, who was booted out of the Dutch East India Company board and then kind of made it his mission to bring down the company and started a short selling campaign. And so the Dutch definitely in the early 1600s kind of set the path for the global kind of market development to take place. And even a century later in 1774, there was a Dutch broker named Abraham van Ketwich that actually launched the first mutual fund. It was called Unity Creates Strength, which is a great name. And the idea there was to give the average investor a diversified portfolio without having to buy all the individual names. So such the opposite of custom indexing. And he launched it. It was a passive, equally weighted bond fund. One interesting kind of anecdote related to that was there were three fund managers for this Unity Create Strength Fund. And to prevent, kind of like systematic investing today is designed to remove the human element out of the equation, to reach that same outcome, Abraham van Ketwich and the two other portfolio managers put all of the securities that they own, so the actual paper certificates, into an iron chest that had three locks on it, and each of the fund managers had their own key. And so to prevent any one of the fund managers from, you know, making an emotional or reactive decision and selling something in the portfolio, the three locks ensured that all three managers would have to come together and unlock the chest with each of their keys and make sure that they were all on the same page.
Fantastic. I love that story, Jamie. I wanted to qualify something with you because you've spoken quite heavily about this, and we're referring now to Tulip Mania, and you're basically advocating for everyone to go and read Anne Golka's book Tulip Mania, as the Hurricat was far more accurate than the widely held beliefs by Charles McKay, which were written in his book The Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of the Crowds. Could you just share what you found in your studies as well, and just had a little bit regarding the crowd of psychology as well, please, Jamie?
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked me about that, because I actually just recently sent over a list of questions to Professor Anne Golgar, who wrote Tulip Mania, and we'll be publishing that interview on Investor Amnesia in a few weeks, kind of going through more explicitly what her research found. But yeah, a couple of years ago, Jason Zweig at the Wall Street Journal, who is a brilliant writer and a hugely passionate financial historian, he recommended that I read this book, Tulip Mania, by Anne Golgar, because it completely changed his view of tulip mania. And so when you get a recommendation from Jason, you definitely check it out. And so I looked her up, and ironically, she had been a senior lecturer of I think early modern European history at King's College London while I had been at King's, but we just, our paths never crossed, or maybe they did. Maybe she like lectured for one of my classes one week, but at the time, you know, she would just be another lecturer to me. So that was funny to find out and made me extra interested in reading the book. And yeah, essentially what she found was that almost all of the stories and anecdotes that have been repeated for 400 years are not true. There was a, you know, tulip trade, and there were, you know, high prices being paid at the time for tulips, but all of the kind of ridiculous stories and examples of mania that are included in Charles McKay's book all come from satirical pamphlets and propaganda that was used at the time of the tulip mania in 1636. And essentially what had happened is that the tulips first started entering Holland in the 1600s. And like any other kind of, you know, luxury good, you can really think of tulips in that age just as art would be today. It was that kind of like luxury, beautiful item. And so just like art, you know, fetches very high prices today. And there are people that go to a modern art museum and say, you know, how I could do that. How is that worth something like that? But people pay the price. In the 1600s, when tulips started entering Holland, there was a tulip trade that started developing, you know, merchants that would import these tulips and sell them. And there's kind of a whole horticultural community around this trade. People trying to figure out the kind of science behind why certain tulips looked certain ways and how to, you know, plant them so that they would get prettier colors and be more unique, et cetera. And as interest grew and the kind of wealthy class was buying up these flowers, the merchants involved in the trade, they themselves started to, you know, make more money and kind of rise up the ranks of society because of this popular tulip trade and the popularity of the flowers. And the wealthy elite did not like that because, you know, they wanted to be very much at the top of the social strata in society. And they did not like the fact that these, in their view, kind of lesser people, new money, were getting more status and wealth and kind of coming for their status. And so what they did was they put out a lot of essentially propaganda, you know, these pamphlets that had stories of people drowning themselves in the canals after losing money in tulip trade, husbands that spent all day at the tavern kind of day trading tulip bulbs while their families starved at home, people going bankrupt, people buying tulips for the price of houses, the same tulip bulb being traded 100 times by speculators, and all these really ridiculous stories that were all propaganda and designed to have the impact of changing popular opinion against the tulip trade. And so the problem is that a German author in the 18th century, he went through these original sources and found these pamphlets and everything, And he used the stories and anecdotes and this propaganda as fact and wrote about it in his book. And so then a century later, when Charles McKay is doing research for his book that everybody still reads to this day, he went and used this German author's work as his source material. And that was still, you know, just continuing this propaganda and stories from the original 1630s tulip trade. And so what's happened is that for 400 years, these propaganda and completely made up stories have been passed down through generations, and we still repeat them to this day. But really, it's all the result of just this propaganda and poor historical source material. Basically, Charles McKay is a very bad historian because he just ripped essentially what this German author did. And so Anne Goldgar's research showed that, I mean, she spent years in the archives in Holland going through transactions. And she said that she could not find any chain of transactions longer than five for a single bull. And so these stories, you know, a single bull being traded hundreds of times, nothing. She found, I think, only like three people that lost everything, and they also had other financial issues. So it wasn't even a direct result of this tulip trade. And then there's the whole story that somehow like the tulip mania took down the whole Dutch economy when it crashed, which is the furthest thing from true. It was very kind of small group in Holland that was involved in this speculation and tulip trade. And so it's just fascinating. We talk about fake news today, but this is like some fake news that's lasted for four centuries. And I think it just shows the power of narrative and how, as humans, we very quickly latch on to stories and just kind of repeat them without actually doing due diligence on the accuracy of these statements. So it's interesting to watch every time that there's some speculative bubble, especially in things like crypto or NFTs. The first thing people do is compare it to tulip mania as an example of, you know, tulip trade was stupid, this is stupid, investors are ridiculous, but all the stuff that they refer to from the tulip mania is usually based on propaganda. It'd be like using Twitter today and like, you know, an account like Ramp Capital, or one of like the funny finance meme accounts, and using the memes that they post as like a statement of fact 40 years from now.
Indeed, and then people do it. I'm conscious of the time, so I'm just going to run through a couple of quick questions here. What are the signs that investors and speculators should be looking out for that identify a bubble when it's beginning and also when it's going to burst? Jamie, what should they be looking out for, do you think?
So a good framework that I always like to think of, and you can kind of see occur in most speculative bubbles, especially when there's kind of like a new industry or innovation, is this concept called the three I's that Warren Buffett has outlined before, where you have the innovator, the imitator, and the idiot. And so you'll have an innovator who, you know, creates a new category or new invention, something, and they're the first mover in a space. And they achieve outsized returns because they have first mover advantage. And then as other people see the success of this company, you know, you'll see a wave of imitator companies. And so during COVID, one of the obvious examples was in the electric vehicle space. You had everybody excited about Tesla because Tesla shares in 2020 were up something like 700%, I remember, like halfway through the year. And so people that had missed the boat on Tesla share started looking for the next EV company that was going to go big. And so you had a wave of imitator companies appear. There's so many electric vehicle SPAC deals that went on. And while some of those have been successful, there was a lot of fraudulent ones, with Nikola being the most obvious example. And so that would be an example of the idiot company. And so you have this imitator phase where perfectly viable companies come in, but they are just essentially following in the footsteps of the innovator. And then when you reach the idiot phase, you have a sea of companies formed essentially just to take advantage of this moment and the fact that investors are just kind of blindly hurling their money at anything related to the new category established by the innovator. And so that's when you tend to see a lot of fraud. And so when you see something kind of burst onto the scene and there'd be a wave of new companies formed around that, I think investors should always be particularly cautious, because you want to make sure that this isn't a company that's just kind of capitalizing on the moment and taking advantage of the fad.
Jamie, this is my last question. You're quoted as saying history should be thought of as a compass. How should investors use said compass to navigate modern markets, given all the history lessons that you've taught them and the history lessons that are out there archived?
Yeah, so as you said, the analogy that I always like to use is that history is not like a GPS system or a roadmap. You know, it doesn't, if you read about the 1929 crash and other crashes in history, it's not like, okay, now I know that, you know, when we're this far into a bull market today, you should put your money in industrials or something like that. It's not very clearly laid out the route that you should take. But what it is a compass, so that at least you can see, you know, through 50 manias and crashes across history spanning centuries, what are the kind of common developments and kind of cycles and patterns to these manias and crashes. And so that way you can at least ensure that when you should be facing north, you're not facing south. And so that you can at least try and predict what is more likely to occur, not guaranteed, but you know, when interest rates are low, there's going to be more speculation and more fraudulent companies that are formed. And so that in those moments, you should be more cautious about what you're going to invest in, and ensure that the company isn't just one that can survive in a world of low rates. And so, yeah, I think history, just reading more of it, is the only way to kind of use it well as a compass. But that is how I think people should think of history, and not kind of, you see some of those charts where people like overlay the 1929 crash chart onto the S&P 500 today, like that means anything. And so, yeah, I'd steer away from that application of history and think of it more as kind of a general directional tool that you can use to steer yourself in the right direction.
Absolutely brilliant. Jamie, we're going to have to come back and do another part two, because I've got about another 20 questions here to ask you. Ladies and gents, that was Jamie Catherwood, a vice president at O'Shaughnessy Asset Management, the founder of Investor Amnesia, also known as the Finance History Guy. Jamie, it's been an absolute delight. We didn't get to talk about Tottenham Hotspur, your love of Spurs, but we'll do that another time. Thank you for being on the Investing Matters podcast. Take care, mate. God bless you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to Investing Matters. Be sure to check out the London South East website for free tools and info to research your next investment. You can also join in the conversation on our social media channels. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more content, including our CEO interviews. Catch you next time.